vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 12, Chapter 10, Shiva and Uma glorify Markandeya. It's 3 through... Is it 6 or 7? I forget now. 3, 4, 5, 6. Anyway, I'll figure it out. Okay, 7. Yeah, 7. 3 through 7. Okay, so word meanings for text 3. Sutta Uvacha, Sutta Goswami said, Tam, him, Markandeya Rishi, evam, thus, nibrita atmanam. His mind completely absorbed in trance. Vrishina, on his bull, Divi, in the sky, paryatan, traveling, Rudranya, accompanied by his consort Rudrani, Uma, Bhagavan, the powerful Lord, Rudra, Shiva, the Darsha, saw, Swaganai, by his entourage, Vrittaha, surrounded. Sutta Uvacha. Tamevam nipritatmanam Rishena divi paryatam Rudranya Bhagavan Rudro Dadarsha Swaganarvrita Sutta Vacha Tamevam nipritatmanam Vrishena divi paryatam Rudranya Bhagavan Rudro Dadarsha Swaganarvrita Sutta Vacha Tamevam nipritatmanam Rishena divi paryatam Rudranya Bhagavan Rudro Dadarsha Swaganarvrita Translation, Sutta Goswami said, Lord Rudra, traveling in the sky on his boat and accompanied by his consort, Rudrani, as well as his personal associates, observed Markandeya in trance. Text 4. Ato matam rishim viksha girisham samabhasita Pashimam Bhagavan Vikram Nibritatmendriyashayam. Goddess Uma, seeing the sage, addressed Lord Girish, My Lord, just see this learned Brahmana, his body, mind, and senses motionless in trance. Text 5. Nibrito da jusha vrato bata paye yatarnavaha purvasya tapasa sakshat samsidim siddhido bhavan. He is as calm as the waters of the ocean when the wind has ceased and the fish remains still. Therefore, my Lord, since you bestow perfection on the performers of austerity, please award this sage the perfection that is obviously due him. Text 6. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Naivetyatya Shisha Kwapi Paramarshir Moksham Apyuta Bhaktim Param Bhagavati Labdhavam Purushevyaye. Lord Shiva replied, Surely this saintly Brahmana does not desire any benediction, not even liberation itself, for he has attained pure devotional service unto the inexhaustible personality of Godhead. And finally, text 7. Atapi sambhadishyamo bhavanye tena saduna ayam hi paramo labho Narinam sadhu samadhamaha. Oh, I forgot to read the purport. Translation. Still, my dear Bhavani, let us talk with this saintly personality. After all, association with saintly devotees is man's highest achievement. In the purport to text 6, the words naivetchatyashisha kwapi indicate that Markandeya Rishi was uninterested in any reward available on any planet within the universe. Nor did he want liberation, for he had achieved the Supreme Lord himself. Omagyanatimirandasya gyananjana shalakaya Chakshurun militam mena tasmai shri gurave namaha. We have many nice scenes in the Srimad Bhagavatam. We can picture this, we read this, we can see what's going on here. Lord Rudra, Lord Shiva is arriving because Markandeya is meditating, as he has been doing for millions and millions of years. And Lord Shiva and his wife, his consort, Rudrani, or Uma, maybe, they're traveling around riding on a bull, Nandi. That's how they travel. Here it says Divi, they're traveling in the sky. So we could say, by chance they arrived there, but what is the chance of one person meeting another when you're traveling on the whole universe? It's extremely rare to meet somebody in, you know, New York City, what to speak of the whole universe. So we can say it's not by chance, somehow by divine arrangement. Lord Rudra and Rudrani have arrived there on the back of the bull. Now, we hear a lot of meetings in the Bhagavatam where some great demigods, for example, they arrive, or Lord Vishnu arrives somewhere, or other personalities. And a lot of times when we hear these descriptions, we just think of them, that person, that one person we think. Lord Vishnu arrived and he spoke to the sage. But a lot of times, if you read a little more, or sometimes it's not stated, but sometimes it is, you'll see they're accompanied by their associates. And sometimes it says who they are, but sometimes it doesn't. So I know myself, I just sometimes have this picture in my mind, oh, this person is just coming by himself or herself. But they're never alone. These great personalities, they always have an entourage with them. Why? Because they're so great. They can't go anywhere alone because people always want to be with them. When you're very attractive like that, or very powerful, then you attract people. If you have opulences, then people are attracted. They want to be with you. And of course, you have your servants, your people, your attendants, and so on. So when Lord Shiva and Rudrani travel, or whenever we hear Lord Shiva or Rudrani were doing this or that, and Lord Shiva and Parvati and Mount Kailas, there's always a group of people there. Usually we hear that Lord Shiva is giving class, he's preaching, and different people are there. Like after the Daksha Yajna, when the demigods and Lord Brahma went to see Lord Shiva. So what was he doing? He was preaching. And Narad Muni was there. Narad Muni seems to be everywhere. Narad Muni was there. And so we know his associates are there. So when Lord Shiva arrives, he doesn't just come by himself. He comes with his associates. There's another nice example of this when not only Lord Shiva, but even with Sati, who was part of the Uma, Rudrani, same person. When in the whole, as the unfolding of the several chapters having to do with the Daksha Yajna, so of course there was this disagreement between Lord Shiva and Daksha. So it says for a very long time there was no communication really between Lord Shiva and his wife and her father, Daksha. So he, at one point, after a very long time, Daksha was going to perform another great sacrifice. So Sati wanted to attend that sacrifice because it was a social affair. She hadn't seen her sisters and her mother, her family, and friends for so long. So she really wanted to go. She really wanted to go. But so she tried to get permission from Lord Shiva, and he didn't really give it, actually. He said, "You're not good. This isn't going to turn out good." He said, "Actually, we haven't received an invitation." And she said, "Well, you don't need an invitation when you're going to visit family." But Lord Shiva says, "Well, it's okay. You can show up without invitation as long as the person that you're going to see is not envious of you and says bad things about you all the time." So basically, "I'm not so inclined to go. And if you go, there's going to be problems." So of course, it turns out there was. But there's a nice scene where it says she's going back and forth. She's going in and out of the room. Her mind is agitated. And she's upset with her husband because he won't give his permission. So she just decides, "I'm going to go anyway." And so she just takes off, basically, and starts going to where her father's having the sacrifice. So then all the followers of Lord Shiva, they gather together. "Oh, Sati is leaving. We got to get it together here." And they all group together, and they accompany her. One of the things I always think is kind of sweet about that passage that they're accompanying her, and someone, it says, they gave her the bird that was her pet. So she has a pet bird, and they didn't want her to travel without her pet bird, so someone grabbed her bird and gave her the bird to carry with her as she was traveling. So that's how she went. She wasn't going to go anywhere alone, obviously, because, of course, they're faithful servants of hers. They said, "Oh, we have to go. We have to serve our mistress and make sure she's taken care of properly." Of course, what happened when they got to the Daksha Yajna and it unfolded just as Lord Shiva said, and then ultimately Sati destroyed her own body, the fire of meditation, and it was good that these others accompanied her because they started destroying the place. So that big entourage that was traveling with her, they played into the pastime. So others come to mind, these kinds of scenes. When Dhruva Maharaj was killing the yakshas, just basically slaughtering them right and left. So the yakshas, their leader is Kuvera. And at some point then, well, first Manu arrives. Manu pacifies him, Swayambhuva Manu. And when Swayambhuva Manu, he also doesn't travel alone. We have different scenes of Swayambhu Manu arriving, and it's said that he's accompanied. Sometimes, actually, I'm not sure it says, maybe it says when he left, but when he went to see Kardama Muni, because he was bringing Devahuti, his daughter, to marry Kardama Muni. So Kardama Muni is in this ashram, hermitage, among other hermits, sages living on the bank of the Bindusarovar Lake. And Swayambhu Manu, in the beginning it's just said that Swayambhu Manu arrived with his wife, Shatarupa. So you have this picture in your mind, but I'm pretty sure at the end of the pastime it says they left with their associates. So Swayambhu Manu is the emperor of the world, maybe the universe. It's hard to understand how he rules exactly. Sometimes it says the whole universe. So, and anyway, he's a big personality. So he doesn't travel alone also. So when he arrives, he has so many attendants there. So they're witnessing. That's the other thing, these personalities. They witness all these things that go on between these great personalities. They witness these conversations, for example, when Kardama Muni and Swayambhu Manu, they spoke when they first met. Swayambhu Manu spoke first. And he glorified the Brahmanas like anything. And then Kardama Muni, maybe the order is different, I can't remember. So anyway, the idea was the Brahmin glorified the Kshatriyas and the Kshatriya glorified the Brahmanas. They were saying how important these two different varnas are for the upkeep of human society. So this preaching and these lessons are being spoken, and those who are there in attendance, they're able to witness this and see what's going on and learn so many things from the exchange. Another idea of having an entourage, we hear about the princesses, how they sometimes had thousands of girlfriends. I always think, how could you interact with thousands of girlfriends? But this was the case with Devayani and Sharmishta, that whole pastime in the ninth canto of the Bhagavatam. So when, how does it go? Devayani wanted Sharmishta to, she insisted, and Sharmishta become her maidservant. And her father agreed because he didn't want to get the wrath of Shukracharya, the Brahmin Shukracharya. So she went to become, Sharmishta went to become Devayani's maidservant, and she brought with her her thousands of maidservants, her girlfriends. So big entourage, these important personalities travel with. Of course, we have imitation people like that these days, Hollywood stars and so on, travel with their entourage, and so many people want to get their association. So this is a Kali Yuga twisted version of the more pure what we hear about. Then, of course, we have the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna. Prabhupada told the artist, Krishna is never alone. He didn't like, for example, the painting with Krishna with Om. No, he's with his associates. He's always with his associates, even if it's just, even if it's a devotee, a cow. Cow should be there serving Krishna, because Krishna is not alone. He's not a lonely person. He has friends. That's his rasa. He enjoys with his friends always. So he always has an entourage. When he travels, we read not too long ago, in the 10th canto, about how Krishna traveled to see Bahulashva and Shutadev, and he invited all the sages to travel with him on his chariot. So he had a whole group of sages traveling with him, and they all got on his chariot together, and they went together to see Shukadeva and Bahulashva, Krishna's great devotees. Now Lord Chaitanya, of course, he usually has his associates. In Navadvip, he was always chanting, congregational chanting. He was always with his associates. The rare exception is when he went to South India, and he insisted that he travel alone. Part of the reason for that was originally he was going to Vrindavan and he went through Ramakeli. And of course, wherever Lord Chaitanya went, thousands of people would gather to see him. They wanted to, because he was so attractive, he's the Supreme Lord. So when he went through Ramakeli, he was going to Vrindavan through Bengal. And then he went north of Navadvip, he went to Ramakeli, and then he was going to cut across North India, travel along the path of the Ganges, to go to Vrindavan. But Sanatan Goswami told him, it's not such a good idea to travel with so many people. You're going to Vrindavan on pilgrimage. So Lord Chaitanya agreed. Actually, he walked some distance to Kanai Nathashala. And then he decided, yes, I have too many people with me. So he went back to Jagannath Puri. Another thing I know, reading Chaitanya Charitamrita, how people walk a lot. They walk a long ways. You read the story of Srinivas, for example. He's always going back and forth. And sometimes he just gets there. He goes from Jagannath Puri to Mayapur. And then he meets some devotee, and that devotee says, you should go back to Puri. So practically immediately he turns around, goes back to Puri. It's something like 500 miles. So to walk there is not such an easy thing. So anyway, Lord Chaitanya went back to Jagannath Puri, then he said, of course he was always insisting, he wanted to go to Vrindavan, the devotees didn't want him to go. But then at that point, of course, he wasn't going to Vrindavan, but he wanted to go to South India. He wanted to go preach, and he wanted to see places of pilgrimage. And he insisted, I want to go alone this time. So the devotees, of course, they were heartbroken. Everyone wanted to accompany him, and that was the problem. He said, how can I bring one of my associates? If I bring one, they'll all want to come. What am I supposed to do? I can't choose. So it should be an outsider, he said. Not someone among our intimate group here, but someone who's not so close in. So of course, first he had, was it Krishnadas? Yes, Krishnadas. He's the one who fell down and went away with the Bhattatari gypsies. Then later he went to Vrindavan. The same thing. When he went to Vrindavan, he only wanted one associate. He ended up with two, the devotees insisted. He ended up with two. The second one, Balabhadra Bhattacharya. The second one, his name isn't given in Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's just said the Brahmana. So the Brahmana, he generally cooked for Lord Chaitanya. So Lord Chaitanya didn't want to bring his whole entourage when he traveled to Vrindavan. But generally, he had many devotees, especially during the rainy season. Of course, Lord Chaitanya had a group of devotees in Puri. Their names are given, the devotees who stayed in Puri all the time. And then there were so many devotees in Navadvip. Generally, when the devotees traveled from Navadvip, well, at least the first time it's mentioned, there were about 200 devotees who came. And Shivananda Sena, I always think he's so amazing, he organized the whole thing. Because traveling was very difficult. The Muslims were in control of everything. There were toll stations everywhere. There were murderers, thieves all over the place. There were envious Muslim kings who created havoc, hassled people. And then you had to find accommodations. You're traveling, you have to find, you know, there's no motels along the way. You have to find accommodations and feed 200 people. And one year it says, generally it seems like, because later it says, and this year they brought their wives. So it seems like generally they didn't necessarily bring their wives. They left their wives for 4 months and went to see Lord Chaitanya. But one year they brought their wives, so had maybe 400 people that year, or at least a large number. So Lord Chaitanya was used to having big crowds of people around him. So this is something that came to mind when I was reading this. We don't often think of those who are accompanying the Lord or these great devotees when they descend, especially when they come to see great sages. Priyavrata is another one. Lord Brahma came to see him. And the Daksha, Dhruva Maharaj was describing that. It's described about, he was when Dhruva Maharaj received Kuvera, that Kuvera was accompanied by not only Yakshas, but others also, and they were all worshiping him and offering prayers. So that's part of it. When they travel with these great personalities, they're always glorifying them. Just like kings have people who do this as their occupation. The king wakes up in the morning and they start glorifying the king and his dynasty and his heritage and so on. So Kuvera is arriving on the scene, the Dhruva Maharaj, and these personalities, his associates, they're offering him prayers and fanning him and doing all these things. So Lord Vishnu also is described. Sometimes we see these paintings, the chamaras are there. Sometimes the chamaras themselves are just floating, sort of floating in the air, because their personality is also. So they're part of the entourage. And then you have reciters of prayers who are always glorifying the Lord. The Lord is always being glorified by his associates. Because for one reason, one thing is they can't stop glorifying the Lord. Whenever they're with it, just like if you're really impressed by somebody, maybe it just comes out, oh, you're just so amazing. I don't know how you do that. You're just so amazing. I could never do that. You're impressed and you say things. So the Lord has these close associates who are in prayer. Nanda and Sunanda are often mentioned. They're his chief associates. So they offer prayers and glorify the Lord. So we can understand that this is probably also going on here with Lord Shiva and Parvati. They have their associates and they're glorifying. So let me move on here. It says they saw the sage motionless in trance. So there's a word here, comes up in three of these verses, nibritta. Nibritta is translated here as motionless. I was trying to find out the etymology of the word, because britta usually means to maintain. Britya, just like a servant is called britya, because a servant is maintained by the master. So nibritta, not maintain, I couldn't feel it. And there are other meanings also of britta, but that's the basic idea. Anyway, nibritta means motionless. And we have this interesting description of how motionless he was. Was that in the first one? In one of these verses, it says, oh, it's the next one. Actually, goddess Uma, she's the one who says this. She's impressed. She sees the sage. She says, he's as calm as the waters of the ocean when the wind has ceased and the fish remains still. You probably noted that. What an interesting way to describe it. Usually we just hear how the water is very still. But of course, water can be very still on the surface and very agitated underneath, or at least fish are making the water move. When they move, the water's going to move. So it seems that the idea is, yes, he's still on the surface because it says his body, mind, and senses are still. So we can see that his body and senses are still. He's not moving. But what's going on inside? So what she's implying here is that inside he's also still, nibritta, motionless. He's fixed in trance. He's fixed in meditation. Unlike the yogi described in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, mithyachara, the mithyachara, mithya means false, achara means actor, really. So the yogi who's, this is a description or downplaying the yogi who sits firmly, apparently in meditation, but whose mind is agitated. That's a false yogi, mithyachara. So that's not the way to practice yoga. Of course, this is in the beginning of the chapter, the third chapter, where Krishna is basically saying that this third chapter is about action. You have to act. You might even sit down to meditate, but your mind is going to be active. Even the yogi who's trying to control it, his mind may be active, because it's very difficult to control. So because the mind is like that, always wanting to be active, then be active with your body and mind and senses. Be active, but be active in the service of Krishna. Do your duty. Remain in Varnashram and perform your duty as a service to Krishna. That's better. Perform your duty in Krishna consciousness. So here Lord Shiva is called Girish. And when I first heard this, I thought, oh, Giri Isha. This is what I thought. I was trying to break it up. Giri, of course, Giri means mountain and Isha means the Lord. Then I thought, was this a mistake? That should be a long I. Giri Isha would be Girisha with a long I. But there's no long I here. So I kind of looked around in the Sanskrit dictionary and I discovered it's Girisha is actually what it means. That's the way it's broken. Giri means mountain and Sha means abode or resting place. So Girisha means one who lives on the mountain, which of course means Mount Kailas. Sha, just like Garbhodaka Shahi. That's the idea. Garbhodaka Shahi. He rests in the ocean of milk. So Lord Shiva resides on the Giri, so he's called Girish. Girish, actually, it's pronounced Girish, not Girish. Girish would be the Lord of the mountain. Anyway, just a little observation there. Now, I found it interesting here that when Uma, she's looking and she's seeing the sage, and then she says these things about him. Just like she's saying, his mind is so calm. So you think, well, how does she know? How does she know how what's going on in his mind? And then Lord, and then she says to Lord Shiva, you should give him a benediction, because that's what you do. This is another thing I find interesting, how the idea of pleasing some higher person by performing austerity. Of course, we know that Markandeya has performed great austerities. Besides his meditation, he's performed great austerities. So it's interesting to me that the sometimes great persons, they become pleased by austerity. A notable example is Hiranyakashipu and Lord Brahma. He wanted to get something from Lord Brahma, so he performed this incredible austerity. For 1,000 years of the demigods, he was performing his austerity. So what happened? He did please Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma gave him his benediction. So it's like this, the person doing this is thinking, I'm just going to do something so amazing and so hard that I'm going to get this deva's attention, and he's going to feel obliged. Wow, this person worked so hard to please me. I guess I have to satisfy him. So they do, of course. Of course, later, Lord Nrisimhadeva said, don't do this again, Lord Brahma. Don't give demons benedictions like this. It just causes problems. So he kind of chided him there. Lord Brahma got corrected by Lord Nrisimhadeva. But this is what happened. And sometimes, of course, it's really extreme. Just like this Vrikasura, he was cutting off pieces of his body and offering it to the sacrificial fire. And Lord Shiva, you know, to attract Lord Shiva, where it actually got to the point where he was going to cut off his own head. And, right? Well, actually, Lord Vishnu told him to cut off his head. But he was, you know, this was how extreme it was. Just because he wanted to get some blessing. He thought, this will please Lord Shiva if I cut off pieces of my body and throw them in the fire. And of course, ultimately, Lord Shiva often does. He rewards people. He gives them benediction. So anyway, here, it said that Lord Shiva, Uma says, you tend to give people benedictions, especially you give the perfections, the mystic perfections, the siddhis. You can award those. But Lord Shiva says, actually, he doesn't want any kind of benediction. He doesn't want bhakti or mukti or siddhi. He doesn't want any of those things. Why? Because he has bhakti. So you think, well, how does he know that? He's just looking at the sage, sitting there in meditation. So we have this nice verse in the first canto of the Bhagavatam, where Vyasadeva, when Narada Muni arrives at the ashram of Vyasadeva, so Vyasadeva offers prayers glorifying Narada Muni, and one of the things he says, I printed out the verse because I don't know it by heart, so it says, like the sun, your goodness can travel everywhere in the three worlds. And like the air, you can penetrate the internal region of everyone. As such, you are as good as the all-pervasive Supersoul. So great personalities like Narada Muni, they can see within. The Sanskrit is anta chara. Anta means within, or it's often translated as the heart. The heart in the sense of not the organ, but you know, our internal self. And chara means to go. So these persons can go into your heart. Devotees would often say this about Srila Prabhupada, right? It seemed as if Prabhupada was looking right through me, right into me. He knew exactly what I was saying. Many devotees, they have anecdotes like that about Srila Prabhupada. I was thinking this, and then Prabhupada said exactly in response to what I was thinking. So anta chara, for the great liberated Vaishnavas, they can see. So Lord Shiva, of course, he's Vaishnavanamita Shambhu. He's the greatest of Vaishnavas. So he can also see into the heart of this devotee, Markandeya. We might think of him as a rishi or a sage, but he's the devotee of the Lord. This is somehow his sadhana, or his spiritual practice. He would seem to be a devotee in Shantarasa, at least in this context that we're seeing in here. Overcome by the awe of the Lord, but he's a devotee, and Shiva can see this. And then he says, "I don't need to give him any benediction, but I want to meet him." Because there's nothing greater in this world than meeting a devotee of the Lord. I want to get his association, basically. I don't want to give him a benediction. I want to get something from him. I want to get his association. I want to be blessed by his association because he's so exalted. So let us go and take his association. So now we'll see how that all unfolds. All right, I'll stop here. I won't read through all the verses again. We need to give you time to think. If you have any questions or comments, observations, hands up in the back.
Hare Krishna. Thank you for the nice class. I was wondering why Lord Shiva was addressed as Bhagavan so many times.
Actually, I just came across it recently. I don't remember where it was. It was a verse that was quoted, I think, in a commentary by Jiva Goswami. And he defined Bhagavan. And of course, there's a standard definition of Bhagavan, which refers to Krishna, which comes from the Vishnu Purana. That's how the Bhagavat, by the way, that's how the Bhagavat Sandarbha begins, by talking about this Bhagavan, because Bhagavat Sandarbha is about Bhagavan. So it gives that definition. Actually, there are two definitions close together at the beginning, in some place in the Vishnu Purana. So that's, since the context there is that it's clearly about Lord Vishnu. But there's another verse that just describes someone who has great qualities as being suitable to be called Bhagavan. So, of course, the word literally just means one who possesses Bhaga. Bhaga means fortune. In fact, you can say these words are very similar. In Bengali, we have the word Bhagyavan Ji. Right? Brahmanda Brahmite Kono Bhagyavan Ji. One Bhagyavan Jiva by good fortune, Bhagavan means the fortunate jiva, gets the association of the guru who plants the seed of bhakti. So in that sense, you can say Bhagavan or Bhagavan, they're very close. They both mean one who is blessed with opulence, basically. So one, or fortune, that's the same idea is there. One who is fortunate is blessed with opulence. This is, you can say, Prabhupada sort of applied this to the idea of Christ. He asked people what Christ meant. And I think someone said it meant the anointed one. And Prabhupada said, yes, that's anointed. So that's also the same idea. Anointed with what? Opulence, with fortune, so on. Blessed. We can also say blessed. Bhagavan also just means blessed. So if you consider these different, the broader meaning of the word Bhagavan, even Narada is sometimes called Bhagavan. So other persons throughout the Bhagavatam are just as Bhagavan. But actually, Jiva Goswami talks about this. He says, yes, other persons are called Bhagavan, but you have to consider the context. And when Krishna is called Bhagavan, and why we put so much emphasis on it, we center the whole Bhagavatam, the meaning of the Bhagavatam, on this verse, Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam, is because of the context of that verse. It says there, all of these incarnations and expansions of the Lord, these different avatars, among them, or beyond them, is Krishna. He's Bhagavan among all of them. So he's in a unique category. Just like Krishna's beauty, Vishesha Shobham, unique beauty. Nobody else has Krishna's beauty. So Krishna is Bhagavan, the real Bhagavan, with a big B, you can say, that's Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there are little Bhagavans and big Bhagavans, you could say. Lowercase and uppercase Bhagavan.
So Lord Shiva and Uma were seen Markandeya after he had lived part of one day of Brahma, lived through the night of Brahma in that ocean, live another part of the other day of Brahma. So I think it was after all this longevity of Markandeya, they were going to see him, right?
It says that. I mean, when we were reading recently, it says that he lived through 6 manvantara.
Yeah, it says 6 manvantara, but also Bhagavatam explained that he lived through the night of Brahma.
Oh.
He went through that ocean of devastation.
Yeah, well, I thought it was just one of those other devastations.
And he had lived part of Brahma day before, and then the other day of Brahma also.
So what's the question?
So I'm thinking, no human has lived that long, you know. So that's why they want to see this Muni, because he's amazing, you know.
Oh, well, that's not why they want to see him. They want to see him because he's a devotee. And they're just attracted by him. Right away, they saw, whoa, look at this sage. He's so deep in meditation, they were attracted to that. It doesn't seem at this point that they even knew what his history was. They just saw his qualities by their spiritual perception. They're able to see into the hearts of everyone. So they could see, I don't know if they wanted to hear necessarily, hear his story, what he went through. Because they're not attracted to that necessarily. It's kind of a material thing. See, he experienced the material opulence of Krishna. Of course, he also had darshan of Krishna at the end. But it's like Arjuna. He saw the universal form. So what's in the universal form? Everything that's attractive in this material world is there. And of course, everything that's ghastly and horrible, too, is there. But he experienced that. But then he wanted to see Krishna after seeing that. All right, I've seen enough of that. I want to see Krishna. So that's what their Lord Shiva would naturally be attracted to. He wants to see Krishna and Krishna's devotees, Tadiya, Krishna's devotees, because they're reflections of Krishna. That's what they want to experience. Raghavendra,
you cited the pastime of Sati going against the wishes of her husband to go to the yajna, and apparently then not turning out so well. Then there's the example of Draupadi, who in dealing with Aswatthama overrode her husband's wishes, including Krishna's opinion on the matter. What is a woman to learn from these two examples?
One of the things you see in the Mahabharata is all of these, what's the word, excruciatingly detailed discussions of Dharma sometimes. In fact, this took place when Draupadi, this whole assembly, when Draupadi was disrobed, so there was a whole discussion. In fact, Draupadi was making different arguments. I think it was about whether her husband should be released and whose property she was. That's one example. So she's quoting this Shat Dharma Shastra and they're quoting a different Dharma Shastra. So this tends to come up when you discuss Dharma. Even Arjuna, at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, what was he doing? Quoting Dharma Shastra. So Krishna basically said, forget all that. I'm telling you, do this. So that's the problem. That when you discuss Dharma, sometimes it's hard to end up on what is the bottom line here. Sometimes it's hard to come up with that, because you can always come up with another argument. Like sometimes it seems that way. So Krishna is the resolution, or sometimes the devotee just has to figure it out on their own, just like Arjuna, whether he should kill Ashwatthama or not. Even Krishna spoke in two ways in that. You hear, the first thing Krishna said was kill him at once. So I always think, well, he didn't do that. Did he disobey the order of Krishna? And it says Krishna was testing him. I said, some test. It seems like he didn't pass the test. Krishna said, kill him at once, but he hesitated. Then, of course, there was a whole discussion. And then, it says Krishna agreed, I think, with Draupadi, who had not to kill him, but also he agreed with Bhima, who wanted him killed. It's like, well, Krishna, what do you want? I can't quite figure this out, even what you want. But somehow he knew, because Krishna inspired him within the heart, he figured it out. So ultimately, sometimes it comes down to the devotee's own spiritual intelligence and the inspiration of Krishna. But when you're just on the level of dharma, in the context of varnashram, for example, then sometimes it's difficult to resolve, and you have to rely on Krishna, rely on Super Soul, and do the best you can. That may be the ultimate resolution. What is your motive? Is your motive to serve Krishna? Is your motive to be dharmic, even though there's disagreement upon about what the dharma might be in this particular instance? that can help to resolve it too, what your motive is. Because Krishna's looking for that. Bhava Grahi Janardana. He looks for the bhava, he looks for the heart. What is the devotee's intention in this situation?
I was just curious. Someone called and asked me, why did Markandeya ever decide, let me see this? I mean, you know, once you hear the whole story, it's a little bit, there's a good ending. But do you have any take
why
on
did
it?
He have why
would he
want to
see? Why would he say, my dear Lord, can I see this?
Well, one reason we can give is so that the story can appear in the Bhagavatam. There are lots of amazing stories in the Bhagavatam, and of course there are many lessons. So I suppose the answer to why is that Krishna inspired him from within the heart to do it. That's why he wanted to do it. Otherwise, yes, you would think, well, he's a great meditating yogi. He's not supposed to have any desires, really. But of course, sometimes the devotees want to see the opulence of Krishna displayed. Just like Arjuna, he wanted to see the opulence of Krishna displayed. And you might think, well, why? Of course, Prabhupada did say that he did it for others, the acharyas say. But he didn't necessarily want to see it himself, but he wanted others to see. So that may also be part of the motive of Markandeya. He wanted others to learn lessons. So I'll pretend I want to see, and then everybody else will learn from my pretend desire to see these things. And I suppose also you can say, there can be a little bit of a tinge, you know, of material, just like Bharat Maharaj. He was in Bhava, experiencing the symptoms of ecstasy, and he fell down because he was attracted to a deer. So this is meant to show us that don't think there's no problem here. You know, this comes up in the story of, who is it now? I'm forgetting. It's not Jadabara. I think it's, maybe it's Swayambhuva Manu. Anyway, the idea is there that he would pull himself, or maybe it was Rishabhdev, how he became like he did, like an Avaduta, just completely crazy. Avaduta. So the question is, why did he act this way? He was an elevated, liberated soul. Why did he think it necessary to extract himself so extremely from ordinary society? So the answer given there is because he knew that you just can't trust the senses and the mind. It's just like when a hunter captures some animal, he has to put him in a cage, in a really strong cage, because he doesn't know what that animal's going to do. That's the example that's given. So Markandeya could also have had that thought in his mind. Yeah, I think everything's cool, but maybe let me see if I have any attractions here. Let me see how powerful the material energy is. Let me see it exhibited. Because that power of destruction that's in the material energy is also the power of attraction. That power to attract. I always think of this in the story of Haridas Thakur, when Maya Devi herself comes. So you think, all the attraction of the material world put into one personified form. Imagine how attractive that form is. We hear about people falling off their horses, you know, the princes when they saw Rukmini and so on, or falling out of airplanes when they saw Devahuti, and because they were just in shock at the beauty. So, you know, the attractive power, destructive power of the material energy, you can turn it around, that the attractive power of the material energy is just as strong. So that could have also been his motive to test himself, or to get rid of any last thoughts he might have and enjoying in this material world, any residual stains in his consciousness, wipe them away. Anyway, a few speculations there. over here, Ekadashi Vrata Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. Well, I think you kind of already answered the question very nicely, but just to add, I was listening to the recordings of the classes that I missed when I wasn't here, and the one devotee, whose name I don't know, he seemed like he answered that question, and what I understood him saying was that because Markandeya Rishi was so far out of that I, me, and mine consciousness, that he wanted to see this potency that Krishna had that could make people think like that. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like you were saying with
he
Arjuna.
He wanted to see how it acts on other people, even though it wasn't acting that way on him. Okay. That's a sign of his compassion.
Well, I'm still, probably several days ago, the verses explaining how Markandeya lived for millions of years during the devastation. And I just can't comprehend. I mean, one thing is living for millions of years, but another thing was there was nothing. He was just in water. And, you know, we're to assume he has a material body. So how did he function? I mean, people have to eat and sleep and, you know, do the normal things.
Too. Yeah, what would happen to his body? I don't know. I mean, we know what happened to Hiranyakashipu's body. The ants ate it all. You'd think a fish would eat his body or something. But you know, one thing about the Bhagavatam, a lot of times it doesn't worry about these kinds of things. I often find that because sometimes I think, well, if I were writing this as a novel, then I would say, I would expect the reader might say, well, wait a minute, you just said this over here. And now you're saying this, these still don't seem to add up. So I often come across things like that in the Bhagavatam. So then I think, well, that's not the point of the Bhagavatam, to be perfect in that sense, to adhere to all the rules of writing fiction or whatever. So sometimes, these details are there and whoever's telling the story doesn't bother with it. And so I think, well, unfortunately, I do get bothered with it. So I have to say, don't worry about it. That's not the point of the story. So I think in this case also we can think. Now one thing, last time I gave class, it kind of came up how this was such a long, long time. And just the idea of just living that long. Who could, wouldn't you really get bored or whatever? And I get really tired of it. But because his consciousness was on a different platform, he didn't experience days and nights passing the way we do, or minutes passing the way we do. Just like the difference between us and children, at least we hope, that children can't sit still, especially when they're very small. We may have to sit in a waiting room somewhere for a half an hour, But he brings that little child with you and the child's going nuts, has to do something. So we're kind of like that and we compare ourselves to these great sages. They have patience. They're not influenced by the moving of the material energy the way we are. So, because he's on a different level, so all I can say is he is somehow or other. Now, of course, the simple answer is, well, Krishna performed this miracle, you might say, of allowing him to see it, so he gave him a suitable body to see it also. Just like Krishna gave Arjuna suitable eyes. So you don't have the right eyes to see the universal form, so I'll give you Divya Chakshu, I'll give you divine eyes, they're called, to see this universal form. So he could also give him a body that's not going to be eaten by fish or whatever. It's going to last through it all. Otherwise, how could he experience it? So that's part of the Krishna revealing it all to him, giving him the suitable instrument to experience it. So sometimes these things are not stated directly, so we can infer these things sometimes. Do some creative thinking. Probably call this philosophical speculation, right? As long as you're keeping the Siddhanta in mind and not, going against Krishna and Krishna consciousness, you can try to figure these things out.
I was thinking how Krishna fulfilled his devotees' desire, because it's described that when Lord Shiva came, Lord Shiva blessed Markandeya to live a long life. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just speculating that in reciprocation to that, Krishna gave him this kind of a body that,
right,
yes, he can sustain.
It's also Krishna responding to the blessing of his devotee, of one devotee on another devotee, Lord Shiva on this devotee. All right, stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
perception of one heart to another, not necessarily zero.